For the last several months, the immigration stories dominating news coverage have been about children torn apart from their parents at the border.
2,500 migrant children that were separated during Trump's zero tolerance policy. Now more than 1,000 families have already been reunited.
A border crisis.
And child advocates, Democratic lawmakers, and the United Nations have all condemned the practice, but the administration has defended its actions, saying it acts as a deterrent.
But there is this other thing happening at the border, something that hasn't gotten as much coverage nationally, and it's happening at legal ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border.
So I wanted to go to Nogales, Arizona, after I saw a story in the local paper that showed dozens of migrants who had been camping out right at the port of entry waiting to ask for asylum.
Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri.
Okay, so the fact that they wanted to apply for asylum there was normal. People have been showing up on foot at the same entrance, petitioning for asylum for decades. But what was strange is that it was taking U.S. officials much longer than usual to admit migrants and to sort of take down their case. And it meant that migrants were just waiting there for up to 2 weeks instead of, let's say, a few hours.
So this is happening right next to where thousands of people come in every day with visas and green cards and U.S. passports.
Yeah, so for those who haven't come into the United States on foot at a port of entry like this one, we're not talking like Arizona desert border here. This is an urban area. Nogales, Arizona and Nogales, Sonora are separated by the international border fence, and it's like two cities like right next to each other. And going through the port of entry there is like going through customs at an airport. And right next to that, there's something that we hadn't really seen before, a makeshift migrant camp.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, we're going to meet some of the people camped out asking for asylum at the border. We're going to explain the process of claiming asylum, and we're going to look at how this longstanding policy is changing under the Trump administration.
Okay, so 2 weeks ago, I flew to Tucson and then drove down to Nogales, Arizona to see this camp for myself and find out why families are waiting so long. And before I crossed into Mexico, I stopped by the office of the Kino Border Initiative. They're a humanitarian organization that works with migrants on both sides of the border. I went to the office they have on the U.S. side and spoke with Father Sean Carroll, who says that since the end of April, they started to see the number of people waiting to ask for asylum increase significantly. What used to be one or two migrants waiting to be processed became 100.
And that was because customs was slower to receive the migrants who were arriving. They were told they had to wait on the Mexican side of the border outside the turnstile. And so as people arrived, that line of people became longer and longer and longer.
So who was waiting on this line?
There were men, women, there were a lot of kids, some of them even in diapers. And this is summertime in Arizona, so it's really hot.
Very bad for their health, sleeping out there at night and being there during the day.
He says last month, the wait for these families was for like up to 2 weeks just to have a customs officer take them in and so that they could apply for asylum.
Wait, so then they're staying there? Like they're staying the night there?
Some of them, yes, but the Kino Border Initiative started opening up more space in their shelters that they have in Nogales, Mexico, and also the Mexican government opened up some space for the families to shower, eat, sleep. But there were people who didn't want to leave. They were scared that they would miss their place in line, so they would spend the night there, outside. So after talking to Father Carroll, I left his office and I took like 50 steps to the pedestrian crossing and then walked right into Mexico. And I literally mean I just went through a turnstile because there are no customs agents from either country there.
You just walked through and then you're in Mexico.
Yep.
So where and how did you find the families that were camping out asking for asylum?
I didn't really have to go very far. As soon as I crossed into Mexico, I walked down this sort of covered walkway, and I turned around to come back into the U.S., and I saw them right away. You can't miss this little camp. There was a row of padded mats with blankets and pillows on top. There were two big white coolers next to a case of water. There was a woman laying down next to her teenage son, and two men in their 20s were sitting right next to them. There was a little boy who was maybe 9 or 10 years old, pacing back and forth, looking totally bored. And then I saw a wheelchair at the end of the row of blankets, and all these people told me that they had spent the night right there where I found them.
So all of this is happening outside, like outdoors?
It's outdoors, yes and no. Imagine maybe like a bus station where the waiting area is tile and it has a cardboard-like roof over it.
I mean, are there people who are spending 24 hours there? And where are they going to the bathroom? How are they eating? Is anybody feeding them?
I saw a couple of volunteers with Kino who brought breakfast in little to-go containers. They brought juice, they brought a case of bottled water, and two of the guys who were waiting there told me that a business nearby lets them use the restroom sometimes, but they had been traveling for so long that some of them hadn't even been able to shower in a couple weeks. And they made a joke about how bad they smell. And they said, at least deodorant. We haven't showered in 2 weeks. And she said, you can go to the shelter and shower right now, but you're next on the line.
So if you walk away to go take a shower,
you go to the back of the line.
And you miss the moment when they decide to suddenly come out.
Mm-hmm. Because nobody knows when the customs official is going to come out. So the voice of the guy you heard asking for deodorant a second ago, his name is Carlos Daniel Aguilar. He's 23. He's from Honduras, and he is in a wheelchair. He says that rivals in his neighborhood had been fighting, and that about a year and a half ago, a fight broke out outside of his house. And he was shot in the back, and because of that, he ended up in a wheelchair. It put his whole family in danger. He couldn't really go to the police, so Carlos Daniel and his brother decided to flee this violence and come to the U.S. to ask for asylum. It took them months to get here, and his older brother pushed his wheelchair for most of the trek. They both said they've lost a lot of weight, they are tired, and it's been a rough few months.
I can only imagine. Fernanda, who else did you see there that morning?
Altogether, there were 4 quote-unquote family units. That's what immigration officials call them. The brothers from Honduras. There was a Mexican woman from the state of Guanajuato who had spent the night there with her 2 sons. One was 16, one was 9 years old. And she told me that they decided to ask for asylum after her teenage son was beat up multiple times by local drug traffickers. Next to her was a 19-year-old woman from Huehuetenango, Guatemala. And she was waiting there with her 2-year-old baby girl. And then next to her was a 41-year-old woman from Nicaragua. So she's a single mother. She has a son who's 17 and a daughter who's 13. The Mexican woman did not want to be recorded, and the women from Guatemala and Nicaragua agreed to be recorded as long as they didn't use their names. They are not only afraid for their own safety and the safety of their families back home, but they're a little nervous about how talking to a reporter could affect their case. So this Nicaraguan family, mom and her 2 kids, they left their small town in the outskirts of the city in the north of Nicaragua, and they left on June 1st. They traveled for about a month and a half to get to the U.S.-Mexico border.
So there was a weird sound that was going on?
Yeah, so the clicking metal sound that you hear is actually the turnstile. And so every click you hear is someone coming into Mexico because they're literally, like, right at the end of Mexico. Through the journey of coming from Nicaragua, she and her 2 kids had to sleep in bushes sometimes. They had to ask for shelter. They had to sometimes do a little bit of work here and there wherever they could so that they could eat that day. She says they left because things in Nicaragua have gotten much, much worse recently. With people having their doors kicked down in the middle of the night, houses being burned down, sometimes with families still inside.
Vámonos de aquí porque no queremos estar sufriendo mucho ahí.
You don't even have to know what she's saying, and you can hear the voice that is just consumed with fear.
Well, she's saying that she had to go to her kids and say, I think I have to leave. And they said, I think we have to leave. I don't know if you heard it. It was very subtle, but at one point you hear an extra, like, and that was her 13-year-old daughter. She was sitting right next to her, cross-legged on the floor, and she had her head on her hands, and she was looking down the entire time that we did the interview. And she was sobbing, quietly sobbing. She didn't say a word. When I asked him, what's your plan? And the plan is to sit here until someone from U.S. Customs comes out and says, it's your turn to come in and ask for asylum. To them, this is kind of like, at least we made it here.
Coming up on Latino USA, we talk about how the Trump administration is changing the way the government handles asylum cases. Stay with us. No te vayas.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back. And before the break, Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri was at the Nogales, Arizona port of entry with the families from Mexico and Central America who were camped out right there waiting to apply for asylum. So in what other places are we seeing this kind of long line of people waiting outside just to try to get to see someone?
I have only been to Nogales, but there were stories in the news. There was something on NPR about this happening in Tijuana with people setting up tents. There was a story in The Atlantic of a family that was waiting for asylum in Texas, and an official walked out into the bridge towards Mexico and told them that they shouldn't even approach.
So there's this whole thing about people believing that if you come and you apply and ask for asylum, that the United States is going to let you in and that you're going to be free.
Yeah, so maybe this is a good time to explain the process of asylum. And to do that, I got a little help from Rocio Castañeda. She's a legal fellow with the Kino Border Initiative, and she's also working with the Florence Project, giving free legal help to asylum seekers.
So under U.S. and domestic and international law, any migrant who arrives at a designated port of entry, like the one in Nogales, has the right to apply for asylum.
The U.S. government defines asylum as a form of protection for people who have been persecuted or fear persecution on the account of race, religion, nationality, or membership to a particular social group or political opinion. So let's use the 19-year-old Guatemalan woman with her 2-year-old baby as an example to take us through the process.
There's a lot of checks, and one of those checks happens immediately there when they present at the port.
A U.S. customs agent is supposed to sort of, quote-unquote, process her.
Why are you here? Why did you leave? Are you afraid to return? And what I typically tell these women is, don't be afraid. You are going to see an officer in a uniform, and they're going to ask you questions, and that is your opportunity to tell your story.
This is a brief sort of initial statement that will end up in that person's file. It's kind of like an intake report. After that, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, decides whether or not they're going to detain the asylum seeker or let them go and then ask for them to report back to them later. Many asylum seekers, however, end up detained for at least some period of time. Eventually, the person seeking asylum has a more thorough interview with an asylum officer, and from then they go in front of an immigration judge to plead their case.
And that's where a final decision gets made, and there's a background check, etc.
So seeing how long and complicated this process is, this is why the initial step, the one that happens right at the port of entry at the U.S. border, is important. And that's why immigrant rights groups and legal experts are seeing an issue with the delays that are happening there.
It is our position that it's in violation of U.S. domestic and international law not being allowed, because there's a clear process that begins when someone presents under U.S. law.
So what are the officials telling you?
I was denied 2 interview requests in the last month with Customs and Border Protection. I also let them know that I was going to be at the Nogales Port of Entry and that I wanted to talk to somebody. They said no. But what I can tell you is that Customs and Border Protection, as an agency, has officially put out a statement. So I'll read you part of it. Quote, CBP is not denying or discouraging travelers from seeking asylum or any other form of protection, or from claiming fear of return to their home country. When our ports of entry reach capacity, CBP officers' ability to manage all of their missions, counter-narcotics, national security, facilitation of lawful trade, is challenged by the time and the space to process people that are arriving without documents. From time to time, we have to manage the queues and address that processing based on that capacity. They're essentially saying, we're not slowing down the asylum process on purpose. We're not doing this to discourage migrants. We're doing it because we simply don't have enough agents to be processing them. So much so that they only took 2 families the day that I was there.
But according to the Department of Homeland Security, President Trump has called for an 8% increase to the agency's budget, which puts them at $47.5 billion. So if more money is being spent, Fernanda, how is it then that they don't have the resources to deal with the people who are asking for asylum?
I don't know.
I think this administration has made clear that it wants to limit severely the number of people coming to the U.S.
That's Grace Meng from Human Rights Watch.
Despite some of his earlier rhetoric, it's not limited to people who enter illegally.
She says that the long lines at the border are maybe not just a bureaucratic issue. She believes that the administration is purposely trying to discourage asylum seekers from coming here.
They've painted asylum seekers as lawbreakers, as people who are fraudulently using loopholes in the U.S. system to gain entry. They've been described in really xenophobic terms as invaders. And it's really troubling to see how this administration is gutting a system that was meant to provide refuge and protection.
The United States will not be a migrant camp, and it will not be a refugee holding facility. Won't be.
And aside from the politics and the rhetoric, under the Trump administration this year, there have been 4 real policy changes to the asylum seeking process. 1, officers at the port of entry are telling more people to turn around and wait. They're not denying them an interview, but they are making them wait longer. 2,
the asylum system is being abused to the detriment of the rule of law, sound public policy, public safety even.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions has removed domestic violence and gang violence as qualifiers for asylum.
And I will be issuing a decision that restores sound principles of asylum and longstanding...
3, Rocio, the lawyer working with asylum seekers who we heard from earlier, told me that the asylum cases for people who are in immigration detention are actually being expedited, meaning that, for example, that 19-year-old woman with her baby that I saw at the border may end up in immigration detention, and then she would have a week before she sees a judge, which doesn't leave a whole lot of time for people like Rocio, who's helping asylum seekers in detention, to really get to know their case and then be able to help them. So what happens is she ends up being put on a plane back to Guatemala quicker than she used to. And 4, earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled that immigrants in detention facilities are no longer guaranteed a bond hearing in front of a judge.
The Supreme Court has said that immigrants can be held indefinitely.
Correct.
Give us a sense of how many asylum cases are actually granted.
Not very many. The percentage of denials is actually pretty high, and it's getting higher. According to data from Syracuse University, in 2016, 57% of the cases got denials.
So, Fernanda, let's bring it back to the families that you met at the border. For example, the woman and her daughter from Nicaragua, what's happened with them?
So they didn't have a phone with them, so there was no way to sort of exchange phone numbers. But I wrote my name, my email, and my phone number in a little piece of paper in my notepad, and I gave it to her 13-year-old daughter. And I kind of assumed that I was never going to hear from them again. But then out of the blue, 2 weeks after I met them, she contacted me.
Bueno.
Bueno, hablo con Fernanda.
Sí, soy yo.
What they told me is that the day that I saw them, because they weren't called all day, they stay the night right there outside in the little makeshift camp.
Nosotros nos quedamos en la noche ahí.
Afuera.
Sí, ahí afuera.
And then at 7 a.m., the agents came out and said, we'll take you, we'll process you.
Y en la mañana nos llamaron.
And at that point, the Nicaraguan woman was able to give officials her sort of initial statement. Her two kids were with her the whole time, and they were detained for about a day and a half. What she told me is that after about a day and a half of being in this, what she called it, la cárcel, like a jail-like facility, she was told to sign some papers, and she was told that she would wear this ankle monitor. And they told her, you have to show up to this hearing on this date at this time in New Jersey.
New Jersey?
Yes, New Jersey. Why? Very far from where I met them 2 weeks ago.
And very far from Nicaragua. So why New Jersey?
The woman has a brother that lives in New Jersey, and he is the sort of contact person as far as immigration officials are concerned. He has a permanent address and a phone number. So she was able to say, I'm going to go stay with him. And then he purchased 3 bus tickets for the mom and the kids. And it took them a few days and they ended up in New Jersey.
So for now, they're with their family. She's wearing this ankle monitor. We don't know how long she's going to have to wear that either, right? Like,
yeah, she told me that she's not really leaving the house much because she feels super embarrassed. She says, you know, criminals wear these, and I don't want to walk outside in this community with this thing on my ankle.
It's really unclear what their future is at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, they made it this far, but there's no clear path in terms of what might happen to them. I mean, they could stay or...
they could be sent right back to Nicaragua.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much for this reporting, Fernanda.
Thank you, Maria.
This episode was reported and produced by Fernanda Chavarri. It was edited by Marlon Bishop. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Sofia Paliza Carr, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. Our engineers are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music that you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA.
Those years were probably the hardest for my family and myself because we didn't know if he was alive or dead.
we dive into the world of forensic science and how it helped bring closure to one family. That's next time on Latino USA. I want to tell you about something super exciting that's coming up, because this year Latino USA turns 25 years old, and we want to invite you to our birthday party. On Sunday, August 12th, we're teaming up with City Park Summer Stage to celebrate with Grammy winner Jerry Rivera, New Yorican poet La Bruja,
even if you ain't Boricua, can I call you my peeps,
and famed percussionist Chembo Corniel. So come out, dance, and party with the Latino USA team in New York City's East River Park for free as we all get together to celebrate this important anniversary. I hope I'll see you there.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at npr.org/turningthetables.